It's time for our Friday interview now. It's with the journalist Johan Harry. Young and famous, he had already won numerous prestigious awards for his writing. He was only in his 20s, but then controversy struck. Criticism of his work had been mounting. He reached a critical point in 2011. He was accused of using other writers' material in his articles without making reference to it. And the setback led to a new book about the war on drugs. I've been speaking to him. He started by telling me about his own battle with narcotics.
When I was a kid, we had addiction in my family. And as I got older, I realised we had quite serious addiction with some of my other relatives. And there were loads of things that I wanted to understand about what had happened in this area. You know, I felt like we're told so much by our governments and by our teachers. And I didn't really have answers. I wanted to understand quite basic things like, why did we ban drugs 100 years ago? Why do we keep kind of banning them now, even though a lot of people think it doesn't work? What really causes drug use and drug addiction? And what are the alternatives? So I went on a kind of big, you know, 30,000-mile journey across loads of different countries to try to figure out the answers. And I was really surprised to discover that so many of the things we take for granted about this area, you know, are just wrong. Addiction is not what we think it is. The drug war is not what we think it is. And the alternatives are not what we think they are.
How bad was the drug addiction in your family?
It was quite serious. So, I mean, there were a range of my relatives who had addiction problems, and I have to be careful because I don't want to compromise their privacy. They basically agreed that I could talk about there being addiction in my family, but they asked me not to name the specific relatives, although one of my relatives has spoken about it publicly herself. But one of them was, for example, a quite bad cocaine addiction.
And what about you?
It's very difficult, this, isn't it? So for several years, I used a drug called Provigil, which is a narcolepsy drug. I don't have narcolepsy. I had read that it makes it better for you to focus. And I used that for several years, and I'm very conflicted about whether that was an addiction. I felt I couldn't stop, and it wasn't very good for me.
Well, therefore it was an addiction.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things I talk about in the book is I think we use the concept of addiction way too simplistically. But, yeah, I think there was, you know, that I had a problematic relationship with it. It's not really, the book doesn't, there's like a paragraph about this in the book. The book is the story of the lives of amazing people I met all over the world, from a transsexual crack dealer in Brooklyn to a scientist who spends a lot of his time feeding hallucinogens to mongooses to see what had happened to the only country that's ever decriminalized all drugs. So it's not a kind of personal book in that sense, but I felt it was important to explain up front that I had a personal investment in this, and it was one of the things that set me on this journey. So I thought it was important to explain that.
Yeah, because you know, when you see a drug addict in the street, or you see a drug addict on a film, we've got a movie, on TV, whatever, there is a stereotypical confined image of them, isn't there? I've been around a long time, and I actually don't know the breadth of an addict beyond that stereotypical image.
I think what you're saying is so important, and one of the things that actually surprised me is that that's not just true of drug addicts, that's true of drug users. A figure that really blew me away, and when you hear it, it sounds instinctively wrong, at least if you have the background I had, is the UN Office of Drug Control, these are not liberals, they're like the main drug war body in the world, admit that 90% of all drug use is non-problematic. That means people don't become addicted, they don't overdose, nothing bad happens to them. 90%, right? Amazingly, when I interviewed one of the best...
90%, nothing bad happens to them.
Nothing bad happens to them. And what amazed me even more is that's true even of the most extreme drugs. A guy called Professor Carl Hart, an amazing professor in New York City at Columbia University. You know, majority of people who use crack don't get harmed by it, which blew me away. And I think part of the problem...
Well, it blows me away to the extent, Johanna, you know you're broadcasting the BBC, all this kind of stuff. I can hear the BBC suits now probably panicking, going, come on, you know, is that true?
I agree. And
that's dangerous talk.
Wrong to me, and yet I looked at all the studies, and the figures are very clear. I think part of, you know, the World Health Organization did a major study of cocaine and found that most cocaine users, that addiction is unusual. Now, what's so weird about this is one of the reasons why this seems so striking to us. If you think about alcohol, right, we all know people who drink alcohol, and we all know people, you know, you go to a pub on any night of the week, you'll see people drinking alcohol in a pub, and you know that most of those people don't have a problematic relationship with alcohol because we talk openly about alcohol, we're candid about our experiences. Part of the problem with illegal drugs and the war on drugs is there are many problems with it, but one of them is it's created a kind of false image of drug users and indeed, as you say, of drug addicts even. And it would be like if I said to you, picture an alcohol user, you pictured a homeless person necking methylated spirits in the gutter. it's like that. Now, this is not to say that there are not horrors associated with drugs. I know that very well from my own family. But I think we have to be careful in thinking about how the war on drugs has actually skewed our perspective on how we think about drug use and drug addiction.
Well, and it also leads me to start thinking about drugs being banned.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the best ways to think about this, I talk in the book about the history of why drugs were banned, which is a really shocking story, but I think one of the best ways for people to think about it now is actually look at the country, the only country in the world where drugs are not banned, which is Portugal. 15 years ago, Portugal had the worst drug problem in Western Europe, almost. And 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is a mind-blowing figure. And year after year, they tried the American way. They tried cracking down harder, putting more and more people in prison. I saw the direction they were moving in. You know, I went in Arizona to one of the worst places I've ever been, where women are forced to go out on chain gangs, wearing T-shirts saying, I was a drug addict, this is what you get. They're forced to dig graves in public. You know, and Portugal was trying, it wasn't as brutal as that, but they were trying to move in that direction, and it was failing. And the Portuguese prime minister and the leader of the opposition were honest and smart enough to say, look, maybe we shouldn't move in a direction that doesn't work. So they did something smart. They set up a scientific panel of doctors and judges and agreed in advance, all the political parties, whatever you recommend, we will do. And the panel came back and they said, let's decriminalise everything, but, and this is the crucial second stage, let's spend all the money that we currently spend on arresting drug users, trying drug users, imprisoning drug users. Let's spend all of that instead on really good drug treatment to really get addicts back into the society so they can stop. So things like subsidized jobs. So, you know, if you were a mechanic before you became an addict and you lost your job, they'll subsidize someone to employ you as a mechanic so you have a purpose and meaning in life. The other thing they spent the money on was really honest drug education. And from the time I spent in Portugal, it was really striking to me. The figures, nearly 15 years on, are really striking. Injecting drug use has halved, fallen by 50%.
Wow.
All the studies show addiction is significantly down. And one of the most moving interviews I did was with a guy called João Figueira, who is the leading drug cop in Portugal. And he led the campaign against the decriminalisation. And he said a lot of the things that a lot of your listeners will totally understandably be thinking now. He said, my God, if we decriminalise, loads of people will use drugs, we'll have anarchy, we'll have chaos, completely understandable concerns. When I interviewed him, the exact quotes are in the book, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did happen. And he said not only does he hope the whole world follows Portugal's example, but he actually really regretted that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug users.
I would love, Johan, to see inside one of the brutal prisons for drug addicts, and I know that you have,
Stephen, it was so. It was so shocking. It's this prison in Arizona where they
in the desert.
It's in the desert. The women live in tents, and they're kind of forcibly degraded. One of the most shocking parts of the book that I worked on. I was interviewing one of the women who works on prison reform in Arizona. And I said to her, you know, a question I ask a lot of people, tell me about something that shocked you in the time you've been working on this. And she goes through this list, and somewhere down the list she says, there was the time they put that woman in a cage and cooked her. That was quite bad. And then she carried on. And I said, sorry, Donna, can we go back a second? What was that you said? There was a woman called Marsha Powell who was a chronic meth addict. And she kept being arrested in her early 40s. She kept being arrested either for having meth or for prostituting herself to get meth. And she's put in prison. I should point out, not the prison I was just talking about, a different prison in Arizona. And one day she wakes up, she's suicidal. She tells the prison guard she's suicidal. The doctor says, oh, you just want to get out of your cell. And they put her in a holding cage, which is literally just a cage exposed to the desert sun. And they left her there. And she messed herself and she wept and she begged for water. And they left her there and she collapsed. And when the ambulance arrived, she'd been cooked. No one was ever criminally punished for what they did to her because no one cares, because addicts' lives don't matter. We've had 100 years of being told that addicts are morally lesser than us. Now, I know most people obviously don't support that. And I then went and found out who this woman was because very little was known about her. I found the father of her children. It was a really heartbreaking story of this woman's life. I think you're totally right that that's the extreme edge of how we've been encouraged to think about addicts. You think about so many examples. You know, one of the stories, the story I opened the book with is the story of Billie Holiday and how she was stalked by the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in America and how they played a role in her death. And it really struck me, this story of this incredibly brave woman, this addict, who was told by the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to stop singing the anti-racist song, anti-lynching song, Strange Fruit, and refused, and was so brave and so courageous. And it helped me to think differently about the addicts in my life. You know, it's not only a book about addiction, it's about lots of things, but meeting so many addicts who had changed the world, actually, who'd been so brave, a homeless street addict in Vancouver who started an uprising that completely transformed the country's drug laws, or Billie Holiday.
Now, hold on, tell me about him or her.
Bud was one of the most amazing people I've ever met. Bud was a homeless street addict in the year 2000 in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which was and is the place with the highest level of addiction in the whole of North America. It's like the place at the end of the line and the place at the end of the line in North America. And Bud was watching his friends die all around him. People would shoot up behind dumpsters so the police couldn't see them. But obviously, if you shoot up behind a dumpster, so the police can't see you. If you start to overdose, no one can see you. And you die, your body gets found a few days later. And Bud said, yeah, I've got to do something about this. But he thought, oh, I'm just a homeless junkie. What can I do? So Bud had a very simple idea. He just said, why don't we, the addicts, get together, and in the period when we're not using, we'll patrol the alleyways. If we spot anyone ODing behind a dumpster, we'll call an ambulance. And he did it. And the death rate really, really fell in Vancouver. But what was really amazing is what happened next. Suddenly, the addicts thought, oh, maybe we're not what everyone says we are. Maybe we're not just pieces of filth. Maybe we can do something. So they start turning up at public meetings where they talk about addicts and they kind of the menace of the addicts, and they sit at the back and they put up their hand and say, oh, that's us. What could we do differently? And Bud learned that in Frankfurt, in Germany, they had set up safe injecting rooms for addicts. So a room where you could go, you get clean needles, that kind of thing. And Bud said, we should do that in Vancouver. So they started, him and this group of addicts, it was now a very big group of addicts, started stalking the mayor of Vancouver, Philip Owen, everywhere he went in public with a coffin. And the coffin said, who will die next before you open an injecting room? And Philip Owen was a kind of right-wing businessman. I guess Mitt Romney would be a good person to picture when you're thinking of Philip Owen. He knew nothing about this. After 2 years of being stalked, Philip Owen one day just said, who the hell are these people? And he goes and meets a load of addicts. And to Philip Owen's eternal credit, he has a change of mind. And he opens the first ever injecting room in North America.
So just to be clear, would you decriminalise all drugs?
I think you've got to look at it in two layers. So we already have all the systems of regulation in place for how we should deal with drugs, because we already deal with lots of substances this way. At the moment, what we have is anarchy and chaos, right? We have the trade is controlled by criminal gangs who sell unknown chemicals to unknown users. So what we need to do is end that anarchy and extend the web of regulation we already have. So for some drugs, I would extend the web of regulation we have for alcohol. So I would regulate cannabis like alcohol, for example, which I think is, you know, a sensible way of doing it. There are other forms of regulation for other drugs. So, for example, with heroin, we would treat it like prescription drugs that we currently have. I went to the clinics in Switzerland where they do that, and the results are incredible. Massive fall in overdose, massive fall in addiction, actually, because people, once you stop being a chaotic street user. Now, there are other drugs where it's much harder to know what you would do with. Crack, meth, things like that. Some people would say, keep them illegal. I certainly wouldn't punish the user. I would give love and support and compassionate care to the user. There's a legitimate debate. I think we need to try lots of different methods, like in Vancouver, because, you know, it's 15 years on from Bud's uprising. Overdose is down by 80%. And in that neighborhood, average life expectancy has increased by 10 years. You know, those are the kind of stats that you only get when a war ends. And it really struck me, everywhere I went that's moved beyond the war on drugs, no one wants to go back.
It's clearly a subject that has encapsulated your imagination, isn't it? And you have to do this amount of research into it, right?
Yeah, I think the thing to me is, what struck me so much is, so many of the conversations we have about this are abstract, right? We talk in abstract, like, are you in favour of banning things? Are you in favour of them being legal or whatever? And in a way, it kind of didn't interest me. What I was interested in doing was going and sitting with real people whose lives had been changed by this policy one way or another, and just going back to them and really trying to understand their lives and their stories. And those stories were, you know, like Marsha Powell, the woman who was cooked in the cage, but also the only person to ever make it out of the deadliest Mexican drug cartel, the Zetas, and live to tell what it was like from the inside. I wanted to really understand at every stage how this policy affects real people, rather than just kind of have a... Because in an abstract argument, you can say anything and it sounds reasonable. You know, I could make an abstract argument that banning drugs is great. I can make an abstract argument that providing a legal route to some drugs is great. In a way, I kind of think that's a pointless conversation. I've lost my taste for abstract arguments. Basically, I'm much more interested in sitting with people.
Here comes the irritating question from me, Johan, because you've clearly put a lot into this. And yet when people hear your name, they'll say, oh, that was the guy that was suspended for plagiarism. Do you think you have to go the extra mile now? Do you think you still have something to prove to people? You know, we all make mistakes in life, by the way, right? So, you know, I give you that. Does it still irritate you? Does even someone like me asking a question about it, it must get frustrating?
No, it's not frustrating. When you screw up, you should pay a big price and people should hold you to a higher standard. And I wouldn't want to live in a culture where people could do what I did and not pay a big price. So, no, it doesn't. I don't find it frustrating. I think it's important. And if, you know, someone else had done what I did, I would ask exactly the same question. So,
but do you feel you have to work harder now?
Yeah. And rightly so. You know, so one of the things we've done is there are kind of 400-plus quotes that were said directly to me in the book. So they're all on the website, chasingthescreen.com, so people can hear them. So as you're reading the book, you can kind of hear the people talking to me. And I actually think that's quite a good thing anyway. It's quite a kind of cool feature.
And you know what this game is like. There'll be someone wanting you to make another mistake, trip over something. You know exactly what this game is like. So that they can say, ah, here we go again.
I mean, that's fair enough. It's perfectly reasonable to be sceptical. When someone makes a terrible error of judgment like I did, it's totally reasonable to be sceptical and to be held to a higher standard, which is why I've tried to write, you know, the most transparent possible book, why, you know, Bloomsbury has published it. It's a very respectable company. They fact-checked everything.
I'm not suggesting that they haven't. When you, though, have that error of judgment, as you describe it, and you're in the middle of a maelstrom like that, what does it actually feel like when you're surrounded with chaos?
When you screw up, I don't think you should encourage people to see it from your point of view. So if we were sitting privately, I would have that conversation with you. But actually, when you screw up, you should encourage people to see it from the point of view of people you harm. And, you know, the people I harmed were the readers of The Independent, who deserved me to behave much better, The Independent itself, and some of the people I was nasty about. So I'm not going to, if I go into talking about that, I'm inevitably asking people to see it from my point of view. And I think that's really a way of lessening my responsibility and my guilt for what I did. So I'm not going to do that. Although it's perfectly reasonable. And if I was in your position, I would ask the same question.
You're currently producing Russell Brand's podcast on YouTube channel, are you?
No, I've stopped doing that. I've started work on my next book.
Right. Okay. Well, what was it like doing it? Because you sound to me like this, you know, together, articulate, sensible guy. I mean, I think of Russell Brand, I think of mayhem, chaos, incredibly exciting. But would it marry you with a project like that? Probably not.
That's interesting. You know,
Russell, and I don't know yet. It's just listening to you now.
Russell's a lot more sensible than he seems. But, you know, I think to tediously and laboriously relate it back to my book, you know, one of the things that we really bonded about, me and Russell, is, you know, this question of the war on drugs. And I think it's really worth saying to people, some of the people who endorse this book, like Russell Brand and Elton John, you know, is there anyone listening to this who thinks that if Russell or Elton had been put in prison when they were at the height of their addiction, that they would be more likely to have recovered? You know, virtually nobody, when someone they love becomes an addict, wishes the drug war upon them. They don't want their addicted relative to be sent to prison, to be cut off from ever getting a job again by having a criminal record. What they want is, you know, love and compassion and proper care. And that doesn't mean coddling and all of those things. Sometimes it means being stern with the person. And I think what we should have is a drug policy that gives everyone what we would all want for the people we love.
It's been really interesting talking to you, Johan.
Lovely.
I mean,
to talk to you, Stephen. Thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much, sir.
Cheers. Thanks.
Chasing the Screen is what we've been talking about today.